Busy show Thursday, April 15th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. Well-known network business correspondent Shabani Joshi joined us in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about the possible adaptation of so-called electronic COVID-19 passports. If the state of Connecticut does that, for example, it could help businesses open up quicker and at more capacity. In the 4 o'clock hour, Governor Ned Lamont gave us the latest coronavirus update, numbers on vaccines and also infections. And in the 5 o'clock hour, we talked with a well-known former police chief of Brantford who now teaches criminal justice at the University of New Haven. What the heck happened with that police encounter in Minnesota the other day? A couple of days ago regarding his iOpen app. There's the Excelsior Pass that's already being looked at and actually used if you go to Madison Square Garden in New York. So are we going to see these widely adopted in the coming months? Is your favorite neighborhood restaurant or the arena you want to go to or whatever, are they going to say, hey, we got to scan something? Well, you know, joining us right now is somebody who has been following stories like this. Shabani Joshi joins us. She's reported for, you may have heard of these outlets, ABC News, Fox News, Yahoo Finance, Huffington Post, and more. And Shabani joins us right now to talk about COVID passports and the such. Shabani, hi, it's Paul at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Nice to be with you, Paul.
Thank you. So in the coming months, are we going to have something scanned every time we want to go to our favorite steakhouse or perish the thought, go to a concert again? What are those games? Is this going to become the norm, Shabani, or what?
There is talk that this is going to be the norm, Paul. I mean, we always have a choice as consumers, if you will. If you do not want to get this quote-unquote vaccine passport, and just to clarify what it is simply just proof of vaccination. And you can do that in one of two ways. You can hang on to that slip of paper that a lot of us get when we are vaccinated, but those things can be copied, duplicated, lost. You can throw it in the washing machine and it get disintegrated. And so a digital solution is coming up to streamline the process and also to protect your data, because it is not just about having the data accessible. We want to make sure that the data is credible, that the information that you provide and are accessible through these passports are also protected, encrypted. And there's about 17 different quote-unquote solutions out there, and we don't get a choice as a civilian. It is largely determined by the place and the location and the provider where you get your vaccine. So if you get yours at Walmart or Sam's Club, they have chosen their provider. If you get it at CVS or at your hospital, they have a preferred provider, and you download it in the same way you would download an airline boarding pass. It's that same sort of technology.
Shabani, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Shabani Joshi is the guest. We are talking about these COVID vaccine or vaccination passports. Right back with Shabani first. Traffic and weather together right here, 236 on WICC. And you folks in New Canaan, well, you may be having to, in the coming months, flash a vaccination, a COVID passport, depending upon whether or not the state adopts one under Governor Ned Lamont. The city of New York already using one. If folks, you have to use one if you want to get back into Madison Square Garden and other venues. Shabani Joshi joins us. You know that name. Yep. Business reporter, ABC News, Fox News, Yahoo Finance, and the Huffington Post. You know, Shabani, one thing that drives me crazy, and I'm sure you kind of makes you giggle, everybody's talking about privacy concerns and this and the other, and I get that. I understand that. We do stories, you and I, in this business every day on ID fraud and all these hackers. But I have to laugh, Shabani, when you know, they won't put something on their phone that will get them into a place yet. They have their location services on. They comment on every meal they ate everywhere, and they don't know that their information. I understand it's not HIPAA information, but it's getting ping ponged around all over the world.
You're so right, spot on. I mean, we give Facebook probably more information than we give Facebook and Instagram and Twitter our birth date, our home phone number, and our date of birth and our email. So that is more sensitive to me, as far as I'm concerned, than some of the stuff that we're talking about in regards to the information on the vaccine passport. But what you are pointing to is that There are concerns that the government's going to control and dictate and have access to our information. And what the industry wants everybody to know, it is simply just very sparse data related to the date of your vaccination, the type of your vaccination, location. If you end up moving and you need to get a booster shot, those healthcare providers need that information. And in the case, for example, with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is now having issues, if a provider wants to follow up with you, instead of having to call you and track you down, they could just ping you on that app and say you're due for a booster, or we need to see you in the office for some follow-up. It is a two-way communication vehicle that is meant to make life easier and not anything less than that.
And I'm also reading, Shabani, that a lot of venues and a lot of, say, restaurants, who we've all come to love again and again during this whole COVID thing, a lot of these businesses actually want this, because if they put a little decal on their window, hey, I use iOpen or I use the Excelsior Pass, this actually, I heard explained to me, helps them get back to, theoretically, a better standing, more capacity in a quicker way.
Absolutely. I think what consumers and what we want is everyday people to feel that we're safe. And it's not just us. It's if we're going to our favorite restaurant, it's the waiters and the waitresses and the busboys and the chefs. They also want to feel safe. So it is a way of creating these quote unquote assurances. And, you know, a lot of the experts, I'm a legal expert, but I read a lot of what they're writing, and they equate to these requirements to no shoes, no shirt, no service. If you don't want to wear all those things, then you can go somewhere else and have a choice. And so these restaurants are doing this knowing that you have a choice. If you do not want to provide this, and every state is very different, Florida, Texas, two states that said they are not going to require this within their states. And so you won't need that if you go to those locations. But in other states, as you were mentioning, in New York, Connecticut, other places, they are requiring it. And it is just a way to do it seamlessly, easily, and so that everybody feels safe, so that we can get back to whatever this new normal is going to be. This is going to be a huge threshold for us to get through in order to make that happen.
And again, Shabani Joshi, the theory of travel here, I mean, you and I have seen the stories over the last couple of days. Hey, open up the cruise industry. We have ships now threatening to change their port of registry so they can start cruising again. They're banging heads with the CDC. It would seem to me, and I could be completely wrong, this could help with that as well.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the big cruise liners are already mandating that you be fully vaccinated before you step onto a cruise ship. The travel industry has been amongst the heaviest hit out of all of the industries out there, and for good reason and for understandable reasons. And so they are really pressing for doing whatever they need to do and getting support around this. And one of the things that they're doing is that some of the biggest cruise liners out there are saying, you need to prove that you're vaccinated in order to come on the cruise ship. Now, you know, that's the sort of assurance that most of us need to feel that we can go on a cruise again. And if you don't have that, well, then we can't ever get back to our summer vacations and our normal life the way that we all want to.
Shabani, thank you. Business and tech expert Shabani Joshi. You've seen and heard her at ABC News, the Fox News Channel, Yahoo Finance, and the Huffington Post as well. Shabani, thank you. Have a happy weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. There you go. Yeah, I actually read that over the weekend, folks, that some of these cruise lines, I mean, they've got all these ships, these lines with these boats in docks sitting there for the better part of a year and a half now. They're actually threatening to change the ship's port of registry to a country that cannot or does not come under the realm of what the CDC says, so... It's going to be interesting. Shabani Joshi, Fox News Channel, Yahoo Finance, ABC News, Huffington Post. You have likely seen her. You have likely recognized that name. But again, yes. So, you know, there's not going to be a national one of these passes, these COVID electronic passports. There's not going to be a national standard. It differs state by state. And for example, next door to us in New York, just down the road, if you get a vaccination or have some sort of a vaccine status or test status that you want to be able to use to get into a venue in New York, you use what's called the Excelsior Pass. But as Shabani said, you've got to use the one. And if any Connecticut businesses or venues adopt this here, you're going to have to use the one that your doctor's office uses. I don't know how they would go about that. Do you go to the place where you get your shot or your GP? And, oh, by the way, do you want us to send your information? So as our UCLA professor said the other day, they log on, okay, Mr. Jones, you got your second shot, and it was on May 1st. Thank you. We're going to send that to whatever, the Excelsior Pass, the iOpen Pass. And then you download that to your phone, and then as you're in line to get into a theater or to go to the Schubert in New Haven or to go to the Klein in Bridgeport or to go to the new amphitheater downtown, whatever, or to go to New York, to go to Madison Square Garden, whatever, you just have the door person will scan it. Now, if there's a mistake, who knows? I don't know what it is. If you say, hey, I got my shot, why doesn't it show up? Well, you're also going to have that physical card, too. So,
look after our kids, look after adults, mental health. And I'll tell you why. I'm going to show you some relatively good COVID metrics trending in the right direction that give us some good comfort. But we're also reminded with Miriam here and Vanessa here that we still have some healing to do. And a lot of stress that's been put upon our kids and our families, and what we should do about it and what we are trying to do about that. First, let me just say that we're still doing a lot of testing. We're making sure that's our early warning system, gives us a lot of indication of where the infections are. The positivity rate is low, 2%. That's not zero, but it's lowest it's been in a number of weeks, and that's incredibly positive. Hospitalizations down, you know, that is something we trend a lot. And fatalities, thankfully, in single digits, more than we need. But sixes, all within a band that says we're slowly getting back to our new normal and the vaccinations are working. But that's not good enough. We see around the world and we see around the country that there are hot spots. And from those hot spots, you know, small brush fires can happen. And as I look around the state of Connecticut, we put together this eye chart for you. Josh did this. This is case rates by town. And I can just tell you in a nutshell that the darker the color, the more infection you have. And it's just worth noting as you look at this that there's some trend lines. You can see sort of the more southwest area of the state is a little hotter, maybe a little bit related to the New York variant, you know, coming up. You may be wondering what's the darkest town there, and that's Waterbury. And, you know, Waterbury can have a case rate that's, you know, twice as high as what you see in eastern Connecticut. A lot of that is related a bit to the Naugatuck Valley, North Canaan, Thomaston, other towns that you see a slightly higher infection rate. We're bringing the Griffin vans there. I don't want to see any vaccine left at the end of the day. It's really important. So make a mental note of this, because this next chart is the mirror, is the opposite. This is the vaccination rates by town. And here, it's the darker, the better. The darker the color, the more likely it is that people have been vaccinated. You can probably see, if you can remember, you know, Waterbury, unfortunately, has a lot less likely folks to have been vaccinated. You see along the shoreline there, Lyme is our champion, old Lyme. 75% of the people, not 75% of the adults, 75% of everybody has been vaccinated. I mean, they're really close to herd immunity there. Old Saybrook. A special shout out to the Connecticut River Health District. A lot of these health, you know, local health departments are making an enormous difference, and you can see that sort of on these, on this region. So, if nothing else, this reminds you there's great variability town to town and region to region, both in terms of percentage vaccinated, be a factor of two, and also what that means in terms of infections. We're getting closer. I really want to deal with those places that have the highest infection, make sure we do everything we can to keep them safe, because that keeps the rest of our region safe. Anyway, here's the vaccine update. I'm proud to say that my age group, 65 and above, is breaking all records with 87% have now been vaccinated, 87%. And let me tell you why I think that's important. You maybe remember 3-4 months ago, oh my God, 50% of people say they don't want to get vaccinated. They don't know. They're hesitant. They're not going to do it. Well, if the 65 and above, where we've had the vaccines available the longest, are a leading indicator of anything, 87% is darn close to a real herd immunity. And if we can replicate what we do in the older demographic, 65 and above, if we get that to the rest of the state, get those 16 to 44-year-olds up there, we're going to have a really nice summer. So that's what we got to continue to work on. And in defense of the 16 to 44-year-olds, they've only had the vaccine available to them for 2 weeks. So give them time to catch up. But we want to catch up. It's really important. We have continued strong demand across all age groups. I want to keep that going. But, you know, last week we had 288,000 doses. A lot of that was related to J&J. You know that J&J has been temporarily paused or pulled from the market. So this week we've only had 179,000 doses available. Overall, 1 million of our folks have been fully vaccinated. That's great. But that means, remember, that there are 2.5 million who have not yet been fully vaccinated, which is why I have to urge you to be careful a little bit longer. J&J update, just for your information, the pause has had little impact on our Connecticut mobile vaccination efforts. That's good news so far. But there is pretty good supply out there. Josh said you could have made calls this morning, gone online this morning on VAMS and been able to get an appointment. Again, some of our vans at the end of the day, today's a little rainy, so it may not be indicative of everything. There are vaccines available. Walk up and get your shot. It's well worth doing. Appointments are available, ct.gov, COVID vaccine, or the phone number, for those of you more old-fashioned, 877-918-2224. But you can walk up to a lot of these mobile vans right now and get that vaccination. It's easy to do. There was a little bit of discussion about this the last few days when the CDC and the FDA pulled J&J due to a, as Dr. Fauci said, less than 1 in a million chance that the J&J vaccine could result in a rare clot. That's less than 1 million. And then the inverse of that is Alex's piece in the Hartford Courant. Who is being hospitalized with COVID-19? Almost exclusively unvaccinated people, which means vaccinated people are, it's working. And it just reminds you that in life, everybody always talks about the risks of doing something. They don't spend enough time talking about the risks of not doing something. In this case, it's the risk of not getting vaccinated. And I think that's what this chart shows as a contrast. You know, with that, let me introduce you again, back by popular demand, to Vanessa Durantes. She cares for the kids who otherwise may not have a family and works every day to make sure their lives are better. And as you know, was helping us out as we thought about immigrant kids as well. So, Vanessa, tell us what you're seeing in terms of the stress some of our kids are going through.
Thank you so much, Governor. And, you know, I just want to make sure everyone remembers that DCF is a consolidated child welfare jurisdiction. So along with the Child Protective Services piece of who we are also responsible for children's behavioral health. So when we think about the impact of this kind of imperfect storm that we have been in over the last year, it's really important to pay attention to children in the context of their families, in the context of supporting their communities. And, you You know, we know that families have needed tangible supports like food and, you know, housing and all of those other things that lead to, without them, you know, stressors that children actually experience through their parents and through their families sometimes. So when we think about mental health, we think about it across a lifespan. It starts with infant mental health, as, you know, the little ones can experience stress through their parents. And then it goes on to the early care and supports that we know we hear Commissioner Bai talk about all the time. Then we think about our young school-age children who have been isolated and separated from their teachers or their friends for quite some time, and that's kind of been unsteady. And now that everything is kind of coming back online with the vaccines and fewer restrictions, and, you know, as much as we stay vigilant, our kids have been experiencing tremendous social isolation. So it's important for us to pay attention as we support them. You kind of move across the lifespan to our teens and adolescents. And, you know, I have to give a shout out to the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board, who has been following very closely the mental health needs of our teens and adolescents. The Connecticut Hospital Association is a great partner with us as we think about the impact to children and, you know, presentment to emergency departments. The Office of the Child Advocate has been working very closely to, you know, really monitor the mental health and behavioral health needs of teens and adolescents. I also want to recognize that there are, you know, communities that support children with specialized needs also have been reporting an increase in behavioral health or concerns about the mental health needs of special populations. So, I'm so glad that you gave us space to talk about mental health, you know, throughout the pandemic, because it's time to lift the stigma. Mental wellness is healthcare. And as we think about the importance of the recovery from this pandemic, we have to think about emotional recovery of our using the supports of our families, our friends, our neighbors, and then the more formal supports that our communities can receive. One of the best ways to access supports is through 211. United Way has been a giant in this space throughout the pandemic. 211 is access to emergency mobile psych supports and all of the other types of supports that can connect families to our tremendous array of our nonprofit providers and stakeholders and communities. Our private nonprofits have been absolutely phenomenal across the pandemic, and, you know, whether it's in telehealth or in-person responses to respond to citizens that are in crisis, and more importantly, to help parents support the safety of children and their own mental health needs. So, you know, I want to make sure that we thank our mental health, our provider partners, for kind of being there right with us throughout this unprecedented time. And so when I think about the transition of the lifespan from our little kids through to our teenagers, I then hand off to young adult services, which are usually handled most efficiently by DMIS. And so my partner in government and the other half of this mental health lifespan is Commissioner Miriam Dolphin-Rittman, who can talk about some of the things that Connecticut has done to lift up services related to mental health on the broader spectrum. Miriam?
Yeah, thank you so much, Commissioner, and thank you, Governor, for the invitation to be here. Yeah, you know, I also want to, you know, start by just thanking our providers that have been just so just active and right there throughout the pandemic in terms of being able to address the mental health and substance use needs that people are experiencing and really challenged with through the pandemic. So really want to give them a shout out for the work that they've done. Whether it's connecting with some of our young adults through telehealth or having in-person appointments as well. One thing that we know for sure is that across Connecticut, behavioral health, whether it's mental health or addiction services, have remained available, and providers have remained open throughout the pandemic. And so really want to acknowledge their good work and thank them for their efforts. You know, one thing we continue to hear, and Commissioner, you mentioned this as well, is that this pandemic in many ways has been a collective trauma. And so people, what we're hearing, are still experiencing the impacts and the ripple effects of going through this past year, whether it's disruptions in family relationships or disruptions in connections with friends or mourning the loss of a loved one. We're hearing that quite a bit, that many individuals are mourning the loss of their loved ones or worrying about one's own health or the health of a family member. And so there is a program that I want to share about and want people to know about that is active in the state. Thankfully, we receive resources from FEMA and also SAMHSA. This is our crisis counseling program. This program is available for all Connecticut residents. And so anybody who is struggling can call 211. We have hired 40 crisis counselors that are available statewide to assist people. The counselors can be accessed through 211 or also through the CT Stronger website. And there are numbers there to also connect to the crisis counseling program. Again, it's available for anybody, but there also is a focus on older individuals living in congregate care settings or people who may be experiencing homelessness and may be in any of the hotels or shelters that we have around the state or faith communities. We've done quite a bit to connect with faith communities around the state, and there are crisis counselors that are actually embedded in working in faith communities as well. So just want to let people know about those services and supports. It certainly over the last year, what we're hearing is that increasingly paying attention to mental health is so crucial. And so I want people to know that services and supports are available. If people are struggling, they don't have to struggle alone. Do reach out. Because help is available. So thank you. I'll turn it back over to you, Governor.
Thanks, Miriam and Vanessa. And we did a program this morning. It's called LEAP. And while our schools are more likely to be open than just about any schools in the country, a lot of our kids still are not going to school. And we're talking to the superintendents today, and the LEAP programmers are knocking on doors or making the phone call, urging these kids to get back. And Miriam, you just reminded me the trauma that some of these kids have been through over the last year. Maybe they lost someone that they really cared about, and it was very close to home, or the stress that they're feeling at home. A lot of reasons we're trying our best to encourage these kids to come back. So thank you for what you're doing. And, of course, Josh and Paul are here as well.
Fox 61.
Hi, Governor. My first question will actually be for you. There were some senators and lawmakers. They gathered at the Capitol yesterday to address the spike in gun violence throughout major cities such as Hartford, and they're requesting funds from the state for violence prevention programs. What are your thoughts and what's being done?
Well, a lot is being done on that. First of all, we've done a lot in terms of prevention. We've worked a lot with all of our different municipalities, not just in terms of overtime for police, but really in terms, again, in terms of mental health, Project Longevity, any of those not-for-profit programs within those different communities we're able to provide funding for. And as Miriam can say, you know, again, with the help coming from the feds, we've got additional resources going to all of our mental health providers just so we can do a better job at the origin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I can add to that, Governor, you know, one of the programs that we've been that we're in the process of expanding is our mobile crisis. So if there are individuals that are in crisis and are struggling, they can call 211. And the crisis teams will go out and assess them and help to connect them to whatever services and supports that are needed that are available. And so that certainly is a program that's available through 211 as well.
Thank you. And then, Governor, final question. Once we hit that percentage, I believe you said it was 60% of residents being vaccinated in Connecticut. Do you already know what changes you would have in place or like certain limits that would be lifted, or is that to be decided?
No, I think for younger people, maybe in and around bars and nightclubs and rock concerts, those are things that we're still a little more limited on. And we got that cohort of people more vaccinated, so they began to get closer to herd immunity. I think those are the things that we'd be able to open up.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Governor, you know, as we look at the vaccination rates by town map, does this highlight the problem that the state is having with equity and getting it into the SBI towns? Or is this just a matter of vaccine hesitancy at this point?
Well, I think I'll start with this and then hand it over to Josh. I think you can see from that map that, you know, often it's in the cities where we have a little more hesitancy and real access problems. We got to continue to do a really good job there and make an extra effort. But you also see in some of our rural areas, you can have a town that's very heavily vaccinated next to one that's less so. So there are some cultural things and local departments of public health, but we've got to emphasize it's in the interest of the entire state, the entire community, to make sure that nobody gets left behind.
And going back to what you mentioned earlier with the majority of hospitalizations being amongst the unvaccinated people, how do you incorporate that into the messaging now that demand may be waning in our state?
We can just show you it works. We can show you town by town that the correlation between vaccination and infections is direct. We can show you in terms of hospitalizations, those that are older are not being hospitalized at this point. It's just younger people there. We've got to do a better job, Matthew, of continuing to get our mobile vans, bring the vaccine to you. I was, Josh reminded me, because with no J&J, we had to change out the vaccines and the mobile vans. And we had our amazing Connecticut National Guard back and forth across the state, getting the J&J out, putting in the Pfizer and Moderna, getting those vans out to people. We just got ourselves a second mobile van. And that second mobile van, you know what it's going to do? Go 3 weeks later after the first mobile van went through so you can get your second shot. It's a little more complicated than it was a week ago. We're still getting it done with a special emphasis upon equity.
And Governor, I want to just add, you were shouting out your age group. My age group is picking up. I got my second shot yesterday, so it's important to have those credible messengers out there. I feel great today, and I feel like I have a suit of armor on.
Last few days, Minnesota now, a former police officer, Kim Porter, is facing serious charges now for fatally shooting a gentleman named Dante Wright. She says, and you can hear it on her, her camera there, or on one of the cameras that was taking the video there, the body cam. She openly says there she mistook her weapon for her taser, and so we have a sad situation there. And of course, the trial of Derek Chauvin continuing in last year's death of George Floyd. Talking about these two for a couple of minutes. Joining us right now is Associate Professor Dr. John DiCarlo, Director of the Master's Program in Criminal Justice at the University of New Haven, former Brantford Police Chief. A lot of folks remember that. Nationally recognized expert on the management and administration of policing. John spent 35 years as a cop and an administrator. He spent the last 10 researching police reform training and interventions. John, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hey, hi, Paul. How are you? Good to meet you.
And thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. John, first, let me get your thoughts here on that body cam footage that you saw a couple of days ago in the deadly shooting of Dante Wright there. And as a guy who does what he does now and as a former officer in chief, what were your thoughts when you saw that?
My thoughts were sadness, and sadness because someone lost their life, Paul, but an increased amount of sadness because 10 years ago when I started talking to the press about researching and change interventions in policing, we began seeing a trend in policing that where mistakes were being made. And we began to suggest some things, some factors that should be changed in policing. And honestly, in that last 10 years that we've been talking about those things, not much has been done. And we have to wonder why. You know, if this were car accidents or if this were airline accidents, something certainly would be being done. And I wonder why we are seeing such a dearth of action in correcting these problems, which seem to be, happening more and more often, even though, obviously police are under a microscope now because of the public recognition that there is a problem. It's time to start taking action, legislative action. There's a lot of research out there, a lot of literature that is telling us what to do. And my question is why aren't we doing it? You know, why aren't we training police officers better? Why aren't, I mean, back when the airlines were having a lot of accidents, the FAA stepped in, and you know, now we have the safest airline industry in the world in the United States. Why aren't we doing that with policing? You know, if a Board of Education saw children not being educated correctly, they would certainly be stepping in and doing something in that milieu. It's time for us to really look at the research, look at what needs to be done, and stop holding on to the status quo and adding an hour here of training and an hour there of training. I think that we have to look, Paul, really at revamping the system of how we select officers, how we train them, what we consider a good officer and what we consider a bad officer, and, you know, perhaps stop using the TV or the Dirty Harry model, you know, that romanticized version of police, and start looking at what we really want officers to be in the United States.
Two things, John. First of all, I said when I first saw the video and didn't know the background of the former officer here, Kim Potter, I said, oh, man, was she a rookie, whatever, you couldn't tell. And then you see, John, she had 26 years experience. And then looking a little deeper yesterday, I found the New York Times did an article, and it was picked up in some of the state newspapers, that this sort of thing that happened with her using a weapon instead of a taser is not all that infrequent. You know, the Times, I think, picked out 10 or 15 examples over the past 15 years or so. So it happens. Why does that happen, John?
There are a lot of reasons why stuff like that happens. You know, going back to that, you know, and I'll explain the police officer reason why it happens in a moment, but it's not only the only profession that it happens in. In aircraft, controls are actually shaped differently because when, you know, when things get tough and moving quickly and in an emergent situation, people make mistakes. And
yeah.
It's called cue utilization. You know, in other words, when we get excited, this is used in athletics all the time. When we go to a certain level of excitement, our performance is increased. But after we go past that, after we get past that threshold of improved performance, our performance bottoms out. It gets worse. And so, you know, you have two things. I don't know what the officer Potter thought she was seeing, if she thought there was a gun. But what happened is that she pulled her taser. This is not her service weapon. This is not the first time this has happened where two things have gotten confused. And I know that, you know, we tell you, oh, the training is, you know, we put it on, you know, the non-dominant side. We color it differently. We train and drill. But the fact is that when things get moving quickly, no matter how you train and drill, it's still possible to make a mistake. And when that mistake involves someone's life, then we have to do something different. And you know, the fact is that in a situation like this, it's easy to make a mistake. And when we have all those psychological and emotive factors that are happening all at the same time, you know, and if you remember in Staten Island, when Eric Garner lost his life, you know, a professor from Columbia Law said, you know, this happened because of a bad law. It happened because they put the police, who are authorized to use force and almost destined to use force when someone resists, in a position to arrest someone that was selling loose cigarettes. So take this concept forward to this case, and we see an officer stopping a car for tags, you know, I mean, for a set of expired tags.
Yeah.
The guy had a warrant on him. It's like, okay, we got his license and registration. We know who he is. Even if he drives away, what are we shooting at him for? You know, there's got to be a whole rethinking of the way that we legislate laws and whether we want the police involved in enforcing those kind of laws, or are they just going to be civil law? You know, do we want police chasing cars through the streets and, you know, for motor vehicle violations and putting citizens in? And this is what the cops are told to do. You know, it's not the cops' fault.
Yeah, exactly. This is John. This is what they're told. John, hang on, because you got a lot of great thoughts here. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. John DiCarlo, University of New Haven, Dr. John DiCarlo, previous police chief in Branford and longtime instructor on police techniques, all that and more. We're talking about the current situation with all the police controversies in the U.S. More with John first, straight ahead, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue talking police policy. The former Branford police chief, and he directs the master's program now in criminal justice at the University of New Haven. Dr. John DiCarlo continues with us for a few more talking to minutes here. You know, John, I've interviewed over the years, and you've obviously talked to the same people I have, a lot of attorneys, a lot of people who get these things when they get to the court level. And I spoke to one or two guys or gals years ago, and they said the same thing to me. And I think this is where we need a little more effort here, John. I can be completely wrong. You tell me. But I remember these attorneys telling me that they go out and tell people in the community or people to come with them, the worst thing you can do is resist. And that's when the bad things generally start happening. Not always, but generally. Isn't de-escalation or getting people, and I don't know how you do this, John, isn't getting people to not resist, getting the message out there, and to de-escalate on all sides, isn't that the key here?
Well, I think that it's certainly one of the important factors. I think that, you know, being a street corner attorney is not what you want to do, because if a police officer is going to arrest you, you want to go peacefully and your day is in court. But that of course, doesn't solve the other problems of police making mistakes. You know, and those attorneys are exactly right. You know, the fact is that if you are being detained by a police officer, if you explain yourself, give your identification, and try to make it as peaceful as possible. You know, there's something called the procedural justice, and it's about how officers should treat people. And of course, the people should realize that when they're being detained, that it's a serious situation. However, we don't want to blame the victims in these cases. Mm-hmm. Very often that we do make mistakes as police officers, and we don't want, you know, we certainly don't want to exacerbate a violent situation or begin a violent situation. But very often when police officers are dealing with people, they're not people who are in a great emotional state. They are people who are on drugs. They are people who are intoxicated. They are people who have emotional problems, who may have just had something wrong with them. They may be mentally ill, emotionally ill. So we can't always put the onus on just saying to the person, behave yourself, because sometimes that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so we have to, you know, when we need people on police departments that don't have a propensity toward violence. We need people on police departments that are trained in de-escalation. You know, what happened, you know, with Officer Potter here? I mean, it just went terribly wrong. And everything that could go wrong went wrong, and someone lost their life. You know, if you go back to Amadou Diallo, same kind of situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's something that keeps happening. And it's incumbent upon us to implore our legislators to change the way we select officers. You know, and we keep on talking about defunding police. And I have to tell you something, the changes that we have to make in policing aren't going to be cheap. It's not going to come from defunding. It's going to come from spending more money on training, on selection and retention, and keeping those officers emotionally healthy, you know, and not letting them get, like other helping professions get, compassion fatigue, secondary stress disorder, and things like that, because we have to have healthy officers in order to keep our communities healthy. You know, you put someone in a police car, you send them out after 6 or 7 years in a bad environment. Unless we keep reinforcing that officers need to act in a certain way and do certain things, then what happens is that they also become they become their compassion becomes fatigued.
No,
and
yeah.
Officer wellness is a big thing here. It was, you know, what happened? You know, what was the precursor to Officer Potter's actions?
Yeah, and John, in that scenario, so taking into account what you just told me over the past few minutes, would that maybe, John, in a better scenario be, well, okay, like you said, he's got a warrant, but he's not wanted for murder. He's not wanted for armed robbery. He's not, at least what we can see, he's not an immediate danger to the public, to the people living around here that we have to protect. So is that what you're talking about? Maybe a graded response here is saying, hey, wait this guy out or call in a backup. Is that what you're talking about, taking a little more, having a little more elasticity in the situation?
Exactly. And, this guy was driving away. Did Officer Potter perceive that he had a weapon? It didn't look to me like that was the case. Of course, I wasn't there, and I hate to, you know, Monday morning quarterback. But the fact is that many of the things that happen in these really rapid situations, and they're mistakes. And Paul, honestly, you know, people lose their lives, and it's a terrible thing. And I was a cop all my life, and I want cops to be the best that they could possibly be. But in reality, you know, there's 700,000 cops in the United States, and there are millions, literally millions of contacts with police every day.
Yes.
And you know, not a very small percentage, result in any kind of force being used. But when we do use force as police officers, we have to be extremely careful. You know, we can't train officers like we train the military. You know, for instance, you know, soldiers have, God bless them all, but they have enemies, you know, and criminals aren't our enemies. They aren't the enemies of police officers. They're members of the community who have gone wrong. They're people's children. And, you know, some of them get violent, and, you know, then we have to give the correct response. But we have to measure that response all the time and make sure that the officers know how to do that and not put them in a situation, them or the public, where people are getting hurt unnecessarily.
Dr. John DiCarlo. John, great stuff. Dr. John DiCarlo, associate professor and director of the Master's Program in Criminal Justice and former chief of police in the town of Brantford. He joined us from the University of New Haven, where he's been for years talking about what is going on nationally, especially with this officer, Kim Potter, who did, apparently by all sites, made a tragic mistake. John, thanks. Appreciate the time. We know you're busy, and we'll be connected with you down the road, we hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it.